loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Olivia Hooker, the last survivor of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, died over the weekend at the age of 103. Dr. Hooker described the notorious 48 hours of death and fire at what was known as the Black Wall Street as a catastrophe that began when a white lynch mob descended on the county courthouse where a black teenager was being held. Next, an Israeli court has ruled in favor of a settler organization seeking to evict 700 Palestinian residents from the Silwan neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The steady expansion of Israeli settlements, illegal under international law, continues. Then we'll discuss the international challenge to the Trump administration's trade policy that disputes the national security justification that the U.S. government cites as a pretext for tariffs. And then more than 80 activist, political, and labor organizations are signing on to a call to action, organizing demonstrations in cities across the country to show solidarity with the migrant caravan as it begins to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border. The actions will be held this Sunday. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the death of a prominent American. Olivia Hooker, the last survivor of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, died over the weekend at the age of 103. Dr. Hooker described the notorious 48 hours of death and fire at what was known as the Black Wall Street as a catastrophe that began when a white lynch mob descended on the county courthouse where a black teenager was being held. We're joined from North Carolina by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, Olivia Hooker's obituary was in the Washington Post today, and she lived an absolutely fascinating life. She was the first black woman to be in the U.S. Coast Guard. She was the first person to have a Coast Guard ship or building named after her. But much of this obituary was about the Tulsa race massacre that took place in 1921. Brian made a point to me off the air earlier today that most African Americans know all about this terrible event, and most white people in America know nothing about it. Can you tell us about it?
Well, first of all, you need to understand the background. First of all, what happened in Tulsa in 1921 was not that unusual. It was one of many pogroms that punctuated that era. I think of East St. Louis, Illinois in 1917, or even Springfield, Illinois in 1909, which helped to give rise to the founding of the NAACP that same year. Recall also the bloody history of Oklahoma. Recall that when Native Americans were expelled from the U.S. Southeast on the Trail of Tears during the administration of President Andrew Jackson, now much beloved by the current U.S. president, many of them wound up in Oklahoma. Oklahoma was supposed to be the land of the Indians, as long as the rivers shall flow and the grass shall grow. But recall as well that in 1889, that promise, like so many other promises to Native Americans, were overturned, and you had the Sooners, which is now the name of the University of Oklahoma athletic teams, that jumped the gun and the land rush to claim land that supposedly had been pledged to Native Americans. That led to a very bloody conflict, which then culminated in statehood in 1907. Yet Oklahoma was able, believe it or not, to develop one of the strongest Socialist Party branches in the early 20th century in the United States of America. But then that was quickly drowned out by the coming of World War I in 1914. I'm sure you know that John Hope Franklin, the late Duke University professor who chaired the Commission on Race set up by President Bill Clinton, was a native of Oklahoma. In fact, one of the more vivid accounts of that pogrom, that massacre, is found in his memoirs. His father was a prominent lawyer in Oklahoma who took many of the cases of those who were slain or injured. This Tulsa massacre represented a larger, wider trend, because supposedly what helped to instigate this attack on black citizens was the fact that supposedly a young black man allegedly and purportedly assaulted a younger white woman. And that kind of episode, as you know, helped to instigate many kinds of massacres, pogroms, and criminal trials, oftentimes leading to lynchings. And socially and politically, they were a way to keep Euro-American women on side, that is to say, to help them to subdue what might have been any kind of opposition to patriarchy because of the so-called desire to maintain racial solidarity. In any case, the ultimate aim of this attack on Black Wall Street, as it was called, was to keep the Negroes poor and destitute as a cheap labor force, which obviously was to the benefit of the 1% in Oklahoma.
You know, there was this reign of terror directed against Black people and Black businesses, Black establishments, but particularly provoked by the return of Black soldiers who came back having been in World War I, of course, fighting in, you know, American apartheid, racist, segregated military units. But those soldiers also came back and were unwilling to stand aside in the face of racist terror. We have here, Dr. Horn, in the same time period, 1919, there's a plaque up in front of Howard Theater up on Florida Avenue, Florida and U Street. Returning African-American World War I vets set up a sniper perch at the top of Howard Theater to try to disperse white racist mobs that were beating and killing Black people all along Florida Avenue. Same time period, there was this wave of racist terror that was going on. And again, it's not, well, it's mentioned once in a while here, but it's certainly not a focus of America's exceptional history. Why do you think that is?
Well, obviously, if the United States wants to portray itself in the international community as a paragon of human rights virtue, it does no good to then trumpet the actual reality of the United States as a hellhole, particularly for Black people and people of color more generally. You should also realize that what befell Washington, D.C. in some ways was a turning point, because what happened in Washington, D.C. marked a real militant fight back, as your vivid description just suggested. And when you saw many of the attackers against Black people go down from Black bullets and Black fists, you began to see a tempering of the kinds of pogroms that sadly and unfortunately was to befall Tulsa a couple of years later. Something similar happened in Houston, Texas in August 1917, when Black soldiers were dispatched to Texas in the midst of a conflagration along the U.S.-Mexico border, which was taking place during the midst of the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 1920. Many of these Black American soldiers were unaccustomed to Jim Crow and U.S. apartheid, and that led them to shoot up the town, which then, of course, in turn, led to many of them being executed unceremoniously. But once again, their ability to fight back and mount a defense helped to temper the raging impulses of the racists and helped to bring to a kind of close that very unfortunate and ignominious era of racist pogroms.
I'm looking at the picture of that trial in Houston, the Progressive website, progressive.org. A century later, a little-known mass hanging of Black soldiers still haunts us. 100 years after one of the least known and saddest chapters in American history, families of executed Black soldiers have petitioned Trump for justice. And then there's a picture of 63 African-American soldiers in uniform sitting in a courtroom, the first of three trials that followed the Houston riot of 1917. In total, 110 men out of the 118 were found guilty and many sentenced to death by hanging. Again, Dr. Horn is right, though. This is the kind of fight back movement that helped and does help and continues to help and change the relationship of forces in America. Certainly, Dr. Horn, when we think ahead to the rebellions in the 1960s, the relationship between Black people and white people in America started to alter, and the way white people started to talk to Black people and about Black people started to alter. You can say whatever you want to say, as the media did, about people who participated in the rebellion, but it changed the dynamic.
Well, you are correct. Look at Watts, Los Angeles, August 1965, when an incident of police brutality led to a week-long uprising rebellion against police terror and U.S. apartheid generally. Certainly, there were a number of Black Americans killed, but it's interesting to note that out of that conflagration came an initial push towards affirmative action. This took place not least because U.S. imperialism was in the global spotlight, because of the allegation that it put forward that it was seeking to bring liberty and democracy to Southeast Asia. Obviously, that was a false statement, made all the more ridiculous by police and National Guard going into South Los Angeles, shooting up black people. But then again, black people were fighting back. LAX, a major U.S. airport, was shut down for a while because there was this idea that black snipers may have been shooting at airplanes. You had firefighters that had difficulty in fighting fires because supposedly they came under fire and assault as well. But once again, out of this bloodiness and out of this furor that gripped Los Angeles, came a change, as you put it, in the relationship of forces, which has led us to where we are today.
We will leave it there. We were joined from North Carolina by Dr. Gerald Horn. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston, and he's the author of dozens of books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An Israeli court has ruled in favor of a settler organization seeking to evict 700 Palestinian residents from the Silwan neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The steady expansion of Israeli settlements, which are illegal under international law, continues. We're joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. He's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker with extensive experience in the Middle East. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be with you guys.
Dan, I'm looking at a video that a frequent guest here, Dan Kovalik, has posted on Facebook, and it shows two bulldozers beginning to destroy this this Palestinian neighborhood. This isn't a shanty town. These are middle, upper middle class, multi-story homes in what looks to be a beautiful neighborhood. What happened with this court case? Why is this happening?
The neighborhood Silwan is one of the most important neighborhoods, Palestinian neighborhoods remaining in East Jerusalem. It abuts the old city, and the gate right next to the Al-Aqsa compound and the Western Wall. So it's an incredibly sensitive spot that Israeli settlers have long coveted. And this group, Ateret Kohanim, to which I have no relation, is a U.S.-backed fanatical settler group. It receives money from U.S. organizations. And basically, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled in its favor. Now, the Israeli Supreme Court, of course, is, Israeli liberals praise it as kind of the last bastion of Israeli democracy. But here we see it's basically just giving a legal approval to internationally illegal actions of evicting 100 families in a very important area. And so these families are now going to be evicted. They will be homeless, and you'll have settlers moving in and colonizing this incredibly important neighborhood. And so, this is the process that's been going on, and it's a major blow. This is also a nod to the fanatics, the Israeli settler fanatics, who seek to not only ethnically cleanse that whole area, but also to destroy the Al-Aqsa compound and rebuild to build a so-called, Jewish temple on those grounds. And so this is all part of a bigger project to do that.
And now that the Israeli Supreme Court has made this ruling, that's the end of it for the Palestinians. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't believe there's any recourse. I mean, when you see what's going to be happening now is, as this video you described, basically Israeli shock troops will storm the neighborhood. You'll have people evicted from their homes violently. And then the bulldozers come and just completely demolish these neighborhoods. And it's a very horrifying sight. And a lot of times you'll just have, the families sitting on the rubble outside, and there's absolutely nothing they can do. And it's just an absolutely devastating scene. I've witnessed this myself.
Yeah, it looks like this has already begun.
Exactly.
It's settler colonialism, settler racism, what the U.S. settlers, what the American settlers, the so-called pilgrims, the separatists, ultimately did to indigenous communities here, certainly what the white South Africans tried to do and did do to the black majority in South Africa, in so-called Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. ethnic cleansing, you know, it's a kind of cultural genocide, and it's a slow motion form of genocide. Because if you think about genocide in these terms, that genocide is the destruction of a people in whole or in part. That's the international definition. Not because of what people have done, but because of who they are. Because of who they are. When you have people being cleared step by step by step out of the homes that they've lived in for thousands of years, literally, and if they stay, and if they try to stay, they're either killed or they're imprisoned.
That's right.
And if once imprisoned, tortured. Now, so maybe genocide is, maybe it's hyperbolic here, but ethnic cleansing is not hyperbolic. That's the goal of Israeli expansionism. And the defenders of Israel must stand up and say, rightfully, yes, we support ethnic cleansing of people. And why? Because God gave this land to some other people. I mean, because what other historical possible explanation could they have for it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there is no justification possible other than just outright land grab, ethnic cleansing. And I mean, the Israeli historian Ilan Pappe called it slow motion genocide. And when you see, you know, that there's no armed resistance in a place like Silwan, this is a completely pacified neighborhood. There's nothing, you know, there's no Al-Qassam fighters there. And nonetheless, their homes are just simply destroyed. And, you know, Israel attempts to erase them from history and pretend as if they don't exist. And so we see, you know, this is the so-called peace process playing out, that's been playing out for decades, that, you know, in this country, while we, you know, talk about, well, you know, will there be two states? When, you know, when will the Palestinians agree to peace? And, you know, and Israel doesn't have a partner for peace. This is the reality on the ground. And we just see, you know, this the narrative that we're fed in this country on throughout establishment media is completely at odds with reality. And so, you know, it's only, you know, the truth is basically marginalized. And you know, on your guys' show and you know, I'm here at RT, we're allowed to speak freely. But that's basically what's been happening for so long.
Dan, there's an unrelated story, but one that's equally important that I wanted to talk to you about. And it's a report in Haaretz indicating that the former Israeli defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, met with Syrian opposition members. Syrian opposition members. That's highly unusual. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, this report just came out this morning, and it doesn't say who exactly the opposition members were. And in this interaction, the former defense minister Moshe Yaalon, who was, you know, he was butchering Gaza in 2014. I mean, this is the man who oversaw the campaign of mass destruction and mass murder in the Gaza Strip, and, you know, 100,000 homes destroyed, 2,200 people dead, including 550 children. Around the same time, he's meeting with representatives from the Syrian opposition. And, you know, this is really the tip of the iceberg. It was revealed a few months ago. It was confirmed that Israel had been supplying basically Contras in Syria with weapons in order to prolong the war in Syria as long as possible. And so, you know, we've seen there are, you know, a lot of people who claim to be, you know, supporters of the so-called Syrian revolution, and also they support Palestine. And you have to support, if you don't support just, you know, the revolution in Syria, then you can't support Palestine. Well, I don't think the Israeli defense minister is a big supporter of Palestinian rights. And so it really just shows what the actual agenda of the war on Syria is, that it's about destroying another sovereign country, and it's fully in line with Israel's basically domination of the region, and you know, at the expense of millions of civilians who either fled the country or were killed. And you know, these people who claim to be you know, supporters of both Palestine and Syria, but completely either overlook these kinds of developments, or ignore it, or do some kind of mental gymnastics to justify it. And, you know, it's really important to understand this in the context of the region.
Dan Cohen is our guest. Dan, you are right about that. There's no, I mean, people have to really think about this, especially progressive people who say that they're supporting the so-called Syrian revolution.
Right.
And yet the Israeli government, which is dedicated to the destruction of independent Arab self-determining governance and particularly progressive governance or movements, if the Israeli government is supporting the same revolution that you are supporting, and that's actually what's happening, then let's just come to terms with the idea that it's not a revolution. It's a counter-revolution, because the Israeli government doesn't and isn't about promoting Arab revolutions against either reactionary Arab regimes like the Saudi regime or U.S. imperialism, or of course, against Israeli Zionist expansionism, which is stealing and humbling and reducing Arab people and Arab lands to a kind of neocolonialism or colonialism. You can't be on the same side with Israel and then say, hey, we're all in this revolution together. It's not a revolution.
Exactly. And anyone, you know, anyone who opens their mouth about this, who says this, you immediately get attacked by a swarm of very toxic trolls and McCarthyites, neo-McCarthyites and kind of these, you know, and hipster neocons who all want to control the narrative and, you know, and lie about what's actually going on in Syria and in Palestine. And, you know, just like they control the narrative about what's happening in Israel and this, you know, in Palestine and this neighborhood Silwan being demolished, we also won't hear about this much in Western media either. So, you know, it's so important to be able to understand these things together and how it works in a bigger picture and not see them as totally isolated.
In our last minute, Dan Cohen, you are a filmmaker. You've spent a lot of time in Gaza, in the West Bank, in historic Palestine. Along with Max Blumenthal, you've made the documentary movie Killing Gaza. Just in 30 seconds, talk about what that movie shows and how people can get it.
Yeah. So I spent about 7 months in the Gaza Strip documenting the 2014 war on Gaza, which killed 2,200 people. And I documented the aftermath. And I show kind of this devastating life under siege in the Gaza Strip. And you can see it on killinggaza.com. There's a link to Vimeo. It's $3 to watch it, $5 to buy it. We're pleased to announce it was just rejected without discussion from the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. So, you know, please share it widely and killinggaza.com.
All right.
Great. Killinggaza.com. We were happy to be joined by Dan Cohen here in Washington. Dan is a journalist and a documentary filmmaker with extensive experience in the Middle East. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Anger over U.S. President Donald Trump's steel tariffs is pushing Europe and China to rip up one of the most sacrosanct unwritten rules in international trade policy. Don't question national security. Brussels and Beijing on Wednesday launched explosive cases at the World Trade Organization in which they will argue that Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum imposed in May cannot be justified on grounds of national security, as the White House claims. We're joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He's the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. Welcome back, David.
Happy to be back.
John, you know, when you were making this the introduction, you didn't mention something that you had written in your own notes about it, which is that the protests by the EU and China to the World Trade Organization, in fact, are joined by Mexico, Norway, Russia, and Canada.
That's quite the group of countries. And this is a very, very unusual situation where, in most cases, if a president or any other leader of a country that's a member of the World Trade Organization cites national security as a reason for a tariff, it's generally just accepted, even if it's not a true reason. This is different. David, can you explain why this is different?
You know, because it's such a reach to suggest that, you know, the competitive position of the United States in terms of telephone equipment could be somehow be at the heart of its national security interests. So it's really a stretch. I think it's implausible. And so I think that's why others have joined in the criticism.
And it's funny, we're talking about countries with which we have difficult trade relations, like Russia and China. But we're talking about countries, like you said, Brian, Mexico, Norway, one of our closest friends and allies in the world, Canada.
Isn't Norway a U.S. state?
Pretty much. At the CIA, we used to call it the 51st state.
Yeah. And David Ewing, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from today, front page, November 23rd, U.S., and it's top of the fold, so it's a major piece. U.S. asks its allies to shun Chinese supplier. Campaign against Huawei stems from worries over possible meddling in 5G gear. I want to read a sentence to you and then get you to comment because it's along the same lines. And I wonder, under these circumstances, will America's allies indeed go along? Here's the from the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. government has initiated an extraordinary outreach campaign to foreign allies trying to persuade wireless and internet providers in these countries to avoid telecommunications equipment from China's Huawei Technologies company, according to people familiar with the situation. American officials have briefed their government countries' counterparts and telecom executives in friendly countries where Huawei equipment is already in wide use, including Germany, Italy, and Japan, about what they see as cybersecurity risks, these people said. This is a pitched full-scale global battle. But the U.S., on one hand, treats its allies as adversaries and then at the same time turns around and says, oh, please help us and shut down the supplier from a Chinese company, a company that supplies telecommunication and telephone parts. Amazing.
Yeah. You know, and many of these countries are impacted by sanctions the U.S. has imposed on their own steel and other metals production. So those are worldwide sanctions now. And now, of course, the focus on China, is this an attempt to get more leverage for left to make a deal, the trade war? Who knows? But Huawei, of course, is a major international producer of telephone equipment. They're the leader in 5G technology now. By the way, China is moving, has 5G in most of the country already, ahead of the U.S. in that area.
Yeah. And that's the cutting edge. That's where things are going.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you can get angry at China and bash China, beat up on China, demand that other, quote, allies sort of help you sanction or tighten the noose on China. But the fact of the matter is the U.S. government, as a matter of policy, doesn't do the kind of infrastructure investment that China is doing that allows China and is allowing China to exponentially, dynamically move forward while the U.S. Well, guess what? I guess we should look at it differently. We have the best missiles in the world. You know, we have the, I mean, most advanced military commodities. But these are commodities of a particular type, a commodity that actually doesn't have any use from the point of view of the utility it provides human beings. It's only useful in war. I mean, it's a different kind of commodity.
Yeah, and it's a frightening one, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you do use them, it's not a good sign.
Certainly, the U.S. is way ahead of China militarily.
Yeah, the U.S. spends five times as much as China on its military budget. If you look at the two budgets, I'm looking, David Ewing, at Global Times, again, a website we cite here, because it's not the official organ of the Chinese Communist Party, but frequently cited as some as a website that reflects the views inside the leading party, the establishment ruling party in China. The headline from today, just published, will EU Japan follow U.S. lead in waging tech cold war against China? And clearly, as evidenced by this article, and people can go to globaltimes.cn to read the articles themselves, it's clear that China's worried that the U.S., in spite of the fact that it's not in Japan's interest, it's not in the EU's interest, it's not in those national interests to break their trade ties with China or Chinese companies, that in fact they will, end of the day, go along with America.
You know, this is, don't forget, I mean, I think for the big picture, remember, China is the leading socialist country in the world today, and it's something that not just the U.S. has to contend with, but I think that for Japan, and for Western Europe, Eastern Europe too now, I think it's strategically something that they have to think with. Will they line up with the U.S. in a more aggressive posture, or won't they? Yeah, so who knows? But I'm I'm just surprised the U.S. thinks this will really work. In my opinion, probably other nations, it's not in their interest to go along with a disruption of international trade. It just seems counterproductive for their own interests as capitalist states.
I wonder, too, if the administration just thought, you know what, let's go for it. Let's give it a try. Probably nobody's going to say anything. And if they do say something at the WTO, we can drag this on for a year or two. We will have made our point, and then we'll just back off. I wonder if this is a policy point rather than a real cause for concern over national security, because, you know, I think it's right that this is not a national security problem. It's not a national security issue.
Unless you construe national security, it's not. You're right. But let's say you're just construing national security as a pretext.
Yeah.
You could say, if China gets stronger, that's bad for America. That's bad for America's national security. It doesn't mean China's going to invade the United States.
Right.
Okay. I think that's well understood that this is a pretext, right?
Sure.
But again, I want to go back to the Global Times and see if it's working.
And that's the question.
Here's what it says. Some U.S. elites advocate cutting ties with Chinese technological giants such as Huawei. Elites in European countries are also feeling the pressure of China's technological progress, influenced by their U.S. counterparts, some of whom believe a technology blockade against China will help protect the technological superiority of the West. But the situation in Europe is very different than that in the U.S. First of all, European countries have no intention to conduct a comprehensive strategic competition with China, and their concerns are more focused on commercial interests. Following the U.S. to engage in a, quote, technological cold war, close quote, with China means huge commercial losses for European countries and others such as Japan. And then, and I think this is so interesting, the newspaper, the Global Times, basically says this. I'll paraphrase it. Look, we don't know whether this will work, whether the European and Japanese allies of the United States will go along, but we shouldn't allow our future to be predicated on the fact that it won't work, that we, China, need to become more self-sufficient, more independent in our research and development. In other words, not dependent on or not as dependent on the world market.
And we've said here on this show that the Chinese have a far longer view of these issues than the United States ever has.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think that's right. And China is prepared. China has some advantages that the capitalist countries don't have, of course. You're right, they're socialist planning. They're planning, standard plans are 5 years, but they have some plans. The agriculture, they have a new plan to, because agriculture still lags behind industry. And that's intolerable to a socialist, that people in rural areas are poorer than people in the cities. So there is a 10-year plan to reestablish agriculture on a stronger socialist foundation and assure prosperity there. So they have longer-term plans, even 50-year plans for some industry. So, yeah, that does give them an advantage in, that they can plan and adjust their economy as needed without, you know, the business cycle disrupting everything the way things happen in the West.
Okay, we were joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He's the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
More than 80 activist political and labor organizations are signing on to a call to action, organizing demonstrations in cities across the country to show solidarity with the migrant caravan as it begins to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border. Those actions will be held this Sunday. We're joined from Sarasota, Florida by Juliana Mushayev. She's a member of the board of directors of the Peace Education and Action Center, and she's involved in this weekend's activities. Welcome back, Juliana. It's been a long time.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us a little bit about these actions. There's a lot to say. There are a lot of different cities that these are taking place in. There are a lot of different ways that people can participate. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, so these actions are taking place in over 20 cities across the country, Sarasota, Florida being one of those cities. There's an action locally where I am. This is in solidarity with the refugee caravan. Basically, there are several demands, including allowing them to enter the country and to have their asylum needs met. There are many things that have been threatened against them, and so we want to make sure that there's enough support for them as they come from the countries that they're trying to flee.
We're speaking from Sarasota, Florida, with Juliana Mushayev. She's a member of the Board of Directors of the Peace Education and Action Center, and she's involved in this weekend's activities. Brian, you have long experience in these kinds of events, I guess I could call them. Tell us what we should expect this weekend and how people can get involved.
Well, John, I want to also explain to the audience why this matters, if we could, a little bit more.
Because, please do.
Because Juliana's right. This is a big response from people around the country, people coming together to say, look, Donald Trump, for political purposes, is trying to demonize this group of working people who are making this 1,000-mile-plus trek through Mexico.
On foot.
On foot. Mostly on foot. We have, you know, people who we've talked to who have been with them. Many of them don't have any water or food as they're traveling. They're completely dependent on the generosity of strangers or the villages or the towns where they come through. And at the same time, Donald Trump is presenting these people like an invading horde.
Oh, yeah. Sending combat troops to the border.
Sending thousands of combat troops. I mean, here are combat troops who are not with their families on Thanksgiving. They're down on the border knowing, in fact, that they're being used as a pawn. At the same time, we had the federal district court judge in the Ninth Circuit and the West Coast say that Donald Trump's recent argument that if any of these people come across the border outside of a point of entry, in other words, a legal official point of entry, that automatically disqualifies their asylum claim, which by all measures, and certainly this is what the district court judge ruled, that's not legal.
No, it's unconstitutional.
You can't say that people who have a valid, credible, legal asylum claim can't exercise that claim simply because they came through a border other than where the border has a point of entry. And especially, and Juliana, let's talk about this. The Trump administration has been making it harder and harder for anyone to come through those points of entry. So people are staying with their families, young kids, sometimes for days, sometimes for weeks, and then they can't get across because the border's not open. And they go down the road a mile and they cross over. And what Trump is saying, well, if we force you to do that and you come across that border not legally, you're going to be arrested and you're never going to have your asylum claim filed.
And let me add one thing to that before Juliana jumps in. I saw yesterday on CNN a chart that showed how many people were involved in this caravan versus how many Border Patrol agents were along the border and combat troops. There are 2.5 times more border agents and combat troops.
That's amazing.
Than there are people.
That's disgusting.
Coming to the border.
That's disgusting. Go ahead, Juliana.
Yeah, I mean, I read that Trump has sent 5,800 troops to the border. It's an extreme waste of resources in terms of, you know, necessity. These refugees are not a threat to us. They're just trying to find safety. And we are spending an extreme amount of resources for absolutely nothing when there's actual things that we need in this country to spend resources on, like the wildfires in California or any number of things. So, and also Trump has the ability to, and the government has the ability to expedite the asylum process so that these people can come in and, you know, can be integrated. And yet instead is using all these resources for troops, an extreme waste of time and money to make a political statement, because his whole campaign and his whole image is based on the repression of immigrants. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Juliana's completely right about that. You know, we're talking about Donald Trump because, of course, he's the main protagonist here against the migrant caravan. But let's think about the Democrats for a moment. Let's think about Hillary Clinton.
Who are silent in this whole thing.
Or they're silent, or they're pretending to care, and then they say, well, we want to abolish ICE, and then we don't want to abolish ICE. But you heard Hillary Clinton's comments about Europe's migration issues. She said Europe has to get its migration situation under control.
Right.
Right? Okay, where are these people coming from? They're coming from Honduras. Why are they coming from Honduras? Because there was one of the reasons there was a coup in Honduras that made life much worse. The progressive government was overthrown. Well, who supported that coup? It was Barack Obama's administration, principally Hillary Clinton. These are Hondurans, Juliana, mainly, who are coming on this caravan.
The Democratic Party now has the majority in the House. So they have the ability to make immigration a priority and move forward with some kind of goal or reform. But they don't even put that on their list of priorities. Given that the Republican Party and Donald Trump have launched a full-blown attack on immigrants and refugees, it would make sense for the opposing party to contribute to the conversation in some way and maybe try to push back a little bit. And it's very telling that the Democratic Party doesn't even have that on their list of things that they want to address politically. It means they don't care. They're fine with whatever Trump is doing, and they don't feel like they need to contribute to the conversation because it's not a priority for them.
Juliana Mushayev is our guest. We're talking to her from Sarasota, Florida, about these large number of actions that are going to be taking place this Sunday all across the country in solidarity with the migrants who are marching in that caravan.
Brian, you talked a second ago about the lack of political resolve to help these migrants. Do you think that the only satisfaction that they'll get, the only justice they'll get, will come from the federal courts? It seems so far that it's the federal courts that are the only ones willing to stand up.
But maybe, because the federal courts, at least so far, have been a brake on some of Trump's most egregious anti-immigrant conduct. But over time, one court's ruling can be, you know,
overturned
by another court. And then you have ultimately the Supreme Court, which is now stacked with right-wing political hacks like Brett Kavanaugh. Yeah, so I don't know. I think that Juliana is making an important point. And Juliana, we have 2 minutes left, so we'll go back to you about the Democrats and what could be done in Congress.
Right.
You know, when the Democrats had control of the House and the Senate and a popular president, that was 2009, 2010, they could have introduced and passed comprehensive immigration reform. They had it all. They didn't have to depend on any other party. They didn't do that, Juliana. 90 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, when Obama was president, we had the highest rate of deportations in the country's history. So it's quite obvious that, you know, the Democratic Party is not the epitome of allies with immigrants coming to the U.S. I mean, they might want to paint themselves as people who are more progressive than the Republican Party. But like you said, Hillary Clinton supported the coup in Honduras. A lot of the things that we're seeing now are products of actions by key Democrats. So it's just an image that the party presents, but it's quite obvious that that's not the reality.
Before we let Juliana go, John, let's just ask her, Juliana, if people want to find out about an action in their city, how do they do that?
So there's a map on pslweb.org, and you can find your nationwide action for November 25th. Most of them are listed on Facebook. But yeah, just go on pslweb and see if there's an action in your city, and definitely join it.
PSLweb.org.
I think there's over 22 now.
Great.
Excellent. That was Juliana Mushayev. Juliana is a member of the board of directors of the Peace Education and Action Center, and she is involved in this weekend's activities. Go to that website and check it out. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. Steve also tweets at Left Eye Blog. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi.
I don't know how we can do this segment without Nicole Roussel. I mean,
like, who takes vacation the day after Thanksgiving?
Terrible, terrible. Anyway, in case you're listening, Nicole, we miss you here. Steve, Pat, let's get started.
Well, since today is the day that they have marketers have chosen to call Black Friday, we got to start with this headline straight from the New York Times. It is a little bit of a rant on my part, I'm afraid.
Wait, you're not supposed to announce a rant in advance, I don't think, but go ahead.
Okay. Black Friday is the official start of the holiday shopping season. We'll be covering it all here. So what I want to know is, did I miss something? Is this now a national holiday?
Yes, it's called Capitalist Thanksgiving, because that's what's happening, is that the entire country has been dragooned into buying stuff from the capitalist, stuff that we didn't know we necessarily needed.
I think it's basically a religious holiday of the official state religion, which is capitalism.
Yes. Okay. So let's see. Is this a new national holiday? Well, what other things, what other holidays are there? Like Small Business Saturday? What is that?
Yeah. What is that?
That's the day, that's tomorrow, I believe. It's the day you're supposed to shop at small businesses.
And Cyber Monday?
That's the day you're supposed to go online and buy computers or whatever. I mean, it's just all marketing gimmicks and just all designed. It harkens back to George Bush's famous admonition to the American public the day after 9/11, when he told us the best thing we could do to fight the terrorists was to go shopping.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a lot of people are going shopping today, there's a lot of workers who are working, and a lot of the workers are working at Amazon warehouses or Walmart warehouses, Target warehouses. Some of those workers, they're not here, I don't believe, but they're in Europe. They went out on strike today. Amazon warehouse workers went off the job. We just saw that a couple hours ago. I mean, that's the other part of this, is as these prices are reduced on shopping days that are discount days. The thing that hasn't shifted, the thing that's not changing, is the wages of the workers, without whom none of this shopping is possible. This is hard work. These workers are working very, very long shifts. They make very little pay. They don't have benefits. And one of the reasons that the capitalists can offer big discounts is that they've discounted themselves by not paying workers, well, I wouldn't say their fair share, because all profit ultimately comes from the labor of working people. But, you know, this is super exploitation by these big companies who are doing these sales. Super exploitation.
Indeed.
Let's go on to another story.
Okay, well, let's go to my favorite story of the week, which, strangely enough, did not get any play in the U.S. press. The two stories I saw were in the British press. I think it's because the elections here and also the fires and other news kind of made it not appear. But here are the headlines. First one's from the Daily Mail. Is Masha and the Bear, that's a cartoon, is Masha and the Bear a Putin stooge? Critics claim cartoon with 4 million subscribers is made by Kremlin to subvert children.
I was worried about this. I was worried about Masha and this kind of this is the Kremlin coming at us, John.
It is.
They're coming at us.
They're targeting the children.
Yeah, they're getting the brains of our children.
You know, and it's like when Pete Seeger was blacklisted in the 50s, and the only work he could get was on children's shows. And then what ended up happening was he inspired an entire generation of people that he otherwise wouldn't have had contact with.
Yeah, the only people who were blacklisted, you could work in science fiction, you could pretend that there's another world where there's actual equality without being considered a communist stooge, or you could go into children's entertainment.
Yeah, lest anyone think that Masha bears any relationship to Pete Seeger, though, in the interest of investigation, I watched 2 episodes of Masha and the Bear.
Oh, you're kidding.
They're all on YouTube, and they're both in Russian, and now they're in English as well. That's why they're now subverting people all over the world, according to these people. They're just very silly little children's cartoons. The one episode I watched was Masha, this little girl, ends up beating the bear in chess after pretending she doesn't know how to play the game. I mean, it's just silly stuff. Has no significance whatsoever, as far as I could tell, of any, you know, grander political scheme. And the fact that they're actually claiming, because that this has some, you know, there's a bear, which is apparent. The whole Masha and the Bear is apparently a classic Russian folktale. And now it's been made into this modern, you know, cartoon. So it is, but it's not made by the government at all. It's made by an independent company, just making cartoons for little kids. And this is just the silliest story ever. But treated very seriously by the Times of London and the Daily Mail.
I hope that Adam Schiff gets on the story, John. Maybe Masha should register as under FARA.
Yeah, she's going to have to go to the Justice Department and register.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I said, I was just surprised with the Russophobia, Russomania going on in this country. I was only surprised that this article hasn't been picked up yet in this country, but it will, I'm pretty sure.
I'm seeing another headline about U.S. troops at the Mexican border. Apparently, they're quite happy.
Yeah, this really got me. This is a Washington Post article. Thousands of U.S. troops celebrate Thanksgiving at the Mexican border. Now, it's true that celebrating Thanksgiving can just mean they ate turkey and they weren't really celebrating. But the fact that this was treated as a major story, if you read the article, it's very clear. The first 11 paragraphs of this article are absolutely a DOD press release. There's not a word changed from a press release that was sent out by the Department of Defense.
It's amazing.
No surprise there.
Finally, in the 12th paragraph, they get around saying something like, some critics say this was all a political stunt. But by then, you've got the whole point of the story.
Well, here's the thing about U.S. troops that, you know, beneath the headlines, underneath the headlines, whatever. These are human beings. These are the enlisted men and women in the U.S. military. They have families. They have kids. If they were not deployed to the U.S.-Mexican border where they could be building tents in a desert, they would have been home with their children or with their parents, with their sisters and brothers. Clearly, they're not happy. They're not celebrating their presence at the U.S.-Mexican border. They know more than anybody that this is a political stunt, but they're actually human beings who have families and have to participate because they're in the chain of command in the stunt. You know, Donald Trump went to Mar-a-Lago. You know, he orders these U.S. troops to go build tents in the desert, but he's in Mar-a-Lago. He's in this luxury country club. He's the guy who never had to go really into the military. He went to a military academy, but he was able to, you know, get out of going to Vietnam. But he's glad to send all of these people on Thanksgiving, on that holiday, to be in the desert rather than with their families. And then if anybody were to protest, let's say take a knee and say, why are they sending the troops to this ridiculous political stunt and, you know, ruining their holiday season so that the Republicans and Donald Trump can make hay out of it? If you took a knee, then that same Donald Trump and the other demagogues would say, hey, you're not honoring the American soldier. I mean, it's so cynical. It's so corrupt. It's so disgusting. And they're not really for the soldiers.
No. And since we're speaking about Donald Trump, I assume you saw this morning what he had to say on Thanksgiving. He's thankful for himself.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier. Surprising that the president, when asked, said, what is he most thankful about? He was most thankful for himself and his contributions to American politics. Let's go on to another headline.
Okay. Well, since we were on Britain before, let's go back to Britain with a story I really liked from The Guardian. Study shows 60% of Britons believe in conspiracy theories.
That's because 60% of the people have, what, they're paranoid or what's going on? What are the conspiracies?
Some of the things they talk about are what I would call actual conspiracy theories. For example, they say 31% of Leave voters, that's people who voted for Brexit, for Britain to leave the EU, 31% of them believe that Muslim immigration was part of a wider plot to make Muslims the majority in Britain.
Okay, that's weird.
Okay, so that I would call a conspiracy theory, but here's the kicker of the article. The most widespread conspiracy belief in the UK, shared by 44% of people, was that, quote, even though we live in what's called a democracy, a few people will always run things in this country anyway. So if you think you live in an oligarchy or you recognize that you do, you're now a conspiracy theorist.
How dare you think that 1% of the people control most of the wealth in society? Something's wrong with you. 1 minute left, Steve, Pat. What's our last headline?
Well, here's a thing that bugged me. It's from the CNN. The Khashoggi case just won't go away for Trump and his Saudi allies. And this is just typical of so many stories which pretend that all of a sudden it's just Trump who's been an ally of the Saudi monarchy and not Obama and Bush and Clinton and the other Bush and the entire U.S. establishment. I mean, they want to pin the whole Saudi relationship on Trump, and it just ain't the case.
Yeah, Trump agreed to sell $110 billion of weapons to Mohammed bin Salman, which is the exact same number that the Obama administration sold to the Saudis in the 8 years before it. Good point, Steve, Pat.
Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. Go to lefteye.blogspot.com for the headlines that we didn't have a chance to get to. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Love, love, love.